In 1998, a number of psychologists ran an experiment where they brought people into a room, and they had in front of them, you know, cookies. I guess I shouldn't say this on Tisha B'Av either. Cookies and radishes. I imagine even on Tisha B'Av you'd eat also radishes at this point. And they told half the people how to eat, could eat the cookies, and half the people had to eat the radishes. And then they were given a half an hour, they were given a difficult problem to solve. And what the psychologists had discovered is that the people who ate the radishes gave up on the problem a lot earlier than the people who ate the cookies. And this is what's, what I understand is known in psychology as willpower depletion. That people only have X amount of willpower. And if they use it on A, they don't have it on B. And it takes a lot of willpower to eat radishes and not cookies. And therefore, they didn't quite have what it took to solve the problem. And I mention this because I think this is a very important point that we often miss in our spiritual growth. We all have X amount of spiritual strength. Some have more, some have less. But if we use it all in one area, we're not going to have very much left for anything else. And it's very important that in sort of setting up our life, that we make sure we don't put all our efforts into one area. Because the more you put into one area, you're going to have very little left to put into another area. When I was at Yeshiva University, so I was in Rav Hirschel Schachter Shir for 4 years in Yeshiva University. This is before he was, you know, famous. And one of the things he would often say in Shir, he would mention a chumra, he would mention a religious stringency, and people would ask him, should we keep it? It's a, you know, he'd mention something you shouldn't do or whatever. So he would always say, it depends. What else are you doing in your life? If you're observing, if you keep all the mitzvot of the Shulchan Aruch, if you pay all your taxes, you go to Minyan 3 times a day, you do whatever you have to do, so then we can talk about keeping a chumra. But if you're not yet observing all the aliphates of Judaism, there's nothing to discuss in terms of a chumra. So of course, I always thought what they mean is, you know, it's the hierarchy. It doesn't make sense to focus on customs when we don't observe the biblical law. That's a very common thing we do. People, you know, biblical laws, people don't concern themselves so as much with customs. You know, my parents' custom, they take very, very seriously. You have to, there's a hierarchy in the mitzvot. But it's also true, if we put our efforts into doing a chumra, then we will probably have less strength left. We'll probably, because we do the chumra, we're less likely, perhaps, to observe the basic mitzvot of the Torah. That's, asked me before, that's why I guess I entitled the talk, the, what did I entitle it? The forest and the tree? That we have to keep our focus on the right things. So hopefully I'm gonna go through a few examples of what I think sometimes we miss the big picture. I'll start with the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the author of the Mesilat Yesharim, great Italian rabbi of the 18th century. So he writes in his introduction, he has a famous introduction that he writes, there's nothing new. He's not going to say anything anybody doesn't know. But it's very important to say things that people know. And more, you know, you have to, if you want something done in a corporation, everything, you have to repeat it over and over again. So that's what he said he was going to do. The Vilna Gaon said that he was wrong. Everything he wrote was new. But that's a different story. So if I apologize in advance if some of these things are not new, but even perhaps that makes them even more important. We'll start that Rav Moshe Feinstein's funeral. So Rav Nissen Alpert, who was a Rebbe at Yeshiva University, was the Talmid Mufak of Rav Moshe. So he said that in the Torah describes the mumim, that disqualifying animal. So one of the mums described in the Torah is a sarua. So what does that mean? It means one limb is larger than the other, or one eye is bigger than the other. that the animal has to be symmetrical, has to fit. If one arm is, you know, 6 inches longer than the other, there's something wrong. So he explained that Rav Moshe Feinstein, everything he did in life is in proportion. There are certain rabbis who are very excel in one area, but are not so great in another area. And others excel here, not so great there. The greatness of Rav Moshe is he went up together. He was equally great at all areas. And that's not to be like that is a moon. Not to be like that is a blemish. To be very strong in one area and very weak. And everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses. You're going to be a little stronger, but there's got to be a symmetrical, there's got to be a balance to what one does. And that perhaps is the meaning. You know, there's a famous argument. There's a discussion. As far as I know, the only source of this discussion is the introduction to the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov is a 16th century work that gathered together all the non-legal, the agadic portions of the Talmud, and with commentary on the bottom. So if you want to learn, you know, the non-legal sections of the Talmud. So in his introduction there, he quotes, we know part of this from other sources, but what he adds is, what's the most important verse in the Torah? So we'll come to the other two famous ones a little bit later, but he quotes that the third opinion of what's the most important verse in the Torah is, et hakeves achat taseh baboker, et hakeves hasheni taseh bein harbayim, the korban tamid, that the daily sacrifice that was brought every morning and every afternoon, the same boring sacrifice day in and day out, it never changed. Keves achat taseh baboker, keves hasheni taseh bein harbayim. Pasuk's mentioned twice in Tetzaveh and in Pinchas. That's the most important verse there. I think if we took a survey, you didn't know this, and you surveyed 600,000 Jews, if one of them said that, that would be one more than I would expect. But the people explain what's he driving at? That the key in life, the most important thing in life, in religious life, in all life, is consistency. Day in and day out. Judaism is 365 days a year, 24/7, doesn't go on vacation. You have to have a consistency to your life. Yes, we're a little bit more meticulous in the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, of course, but it's the consistency. But it also means a consistency in how we live our life. That you can't, like we said before, you're like this over here and like this over there. That's a very inconsistent life. We might call that hypocrisy, depending. I don't know if it's hypocrisy. Rav Soloveitchik said very often what people call hypocrisy, not hypocrisy. People, they act one way here, one way there. It's the human nature where we have all kinds of forces working upon us. But we have to try to make a little bit a consistency. So we can start at Tisha B'Av. The famous story hasn't come up yet of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Of course, people know where's the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa mentioned. I'd like to make a little interactive, small group. People, otherwise, they'll fall asleep. I have to keep you awake a little bit. No, it's tired. It's a long afternoon. It's easy for me to stay awake. I have no choice. But where's the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa? Gittin. Yeah. What's it doing in Gittin? So that was Rabbi Tavori mentioned this idea this morning. It's mentioned in Masechet Gittin. All the stories of the Churban, of the destructions, are in Masechet Gittin. Why in Masechet Gittin? What's a get? A get is a divorce document. The stories of the destruction of the temple is the divorce between God and the Jewish people. God, Kiviyako, divorced us. He sent us away, sent us into exile. Katav la sefer kutuv nishocham mibeito. And you send out of the home of Israel, we were sent away. The get is what's happened. That's why the Churban. That's why, conversely, all the stories of the importance of living in Israel and the beauty of Israel and how wonderful a country, and whoever lives in Israel is if he has a God, and whoever walks 4 cubits in Israel is all his sins are forgiven. All the beautiful, beautiful things about how wonderful the land of Israel are in Masechet Ketuvot, the love between a husband and a wife, the Ketuvah, to demonstrate. So the Agadic pieces of the Gemara are always in, are put properly. The Gemara often, people are not aware of this. People especially, they haven't learned Gemara. They've only learned a little bit of Gemara. Everybody thinks the Gemara goes off topic and it goes onto tangent. It's not true. The Gemara never goes into a tangent. I go into tangents a lot when I speak, but the Gemara never goes into a tangent. The Gemara, everything is structured so perfectly, and everything has a reason. That's what you have to figure out, why things follow. But it was edited with such precision, which is why the Gemara always quotes, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Amar Rav Yochanan, Amar Rav Shimon ben Yochai. They'll quote four things. They're very precise. Who said what, when it was said, where it was said. Everything. The Gemara was edited with unbelievable precision, which is one of the reasons we study Talmud Bavli. The Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, was not edited properly. They didn't have an opportunity. The persecutions in Israel, they couldn't edit it properly. That's why nobody ever learned Yerushalmi. Who learned Yerushalmi? Now, I think Art Scroll, I don't know how far they are in getting the Yerushalmi done, and a little bit, but generally, the Rambam learned Yerushalmi, okay? But very few people learn the Talmud Yerushalmi, because it's not edited. There's no Rashi. Can't learn without Rashi. So it's very hard. The Talmud is edited with extreme precision. So the stories of the Churban are not stam in Masechet Gittin, like the one day they failed to talk about it. But what a lot of people, that's a little bit well known, that the Gittin and the Churban. What's a little bit, I think, less well known is what Perek in Gittin is the stories of the Churban. That's a tougher question. Anybody? Yes. There are 9 chapters in Gittin. Okay, so I think there are 9 chapters, if I remember correctly. So it's in chapter 5. Okay, the middle chapter, I don't think that's the reason. Why it's the 5th chapter? Anybody know what one of the major themes, if you look at the Mishnayos of the first of the 5th chapter of Gittin? So they have a series of Mishnayot on Elu Dvarim Shamru Mipnei Darchei Shalom. These are the laws that the rabbis established to bring peace to the people. Kohen Kare Rishon. You give the Kohen the first Aliyah. You know why I give the Kohen the first Aliyah? Not that fights in Shalom. People, I don't know what people think why I give the Kohen the first Aliyah. You know why I give the Kohen the first Aliyah? Because there are not so many Kohanim. There are not so many Kohanim. And you have less fights in Shul. You only have 8 Kohanim in Shul. You have 50 Yisraelim and 8 Kohanim. So if you gave it to Yisrael, there'd be 50 people fighting. Now only 8 people have to fight to get the Aliyah. That's what Tosfot there and the Gemara says, that the Kohen can be Mochel is Aliyah on a Monday or a Thursday, but he can't be Mochel on a Shabbos. Yeah, Monday, Thursday, no big deal. You know, there are 11 and a half people in Shul, so the Kohen says, you can have my Aliyah instead. You're not going to have any fights. But Shabbos, when there are lots of people in Shul, so the Kohen's not allowed to be Mochel. That's why you'll see on a Monday morning, sometimes they'll call up Yisrael b'mkom Kohen, but they'll never call up on a Shabbos morning somebody b'mkom Kohen, because the Talmud says you're not allowed to, because you'll have too many fights. So Tosfot there writes, Baruch Hashem, that we today, in the Middle Ages, we can't even nullify our Aliyah Monday, Thursday, because our shuls are so full on Mondays and Thursdays, just like on Shabbos. So the Kohen can't give us Aliyah on a Monday or a Thursday. We have too many fights. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, Baruch Hashem, we're back to the laws of the Gemara. We don't like to change the laws of the Gemara, so we're back. On Mondays and Thursdays you can change, but not on Shabbos. Okay. Anyway, that was meant to be a joke, but I guess nobody got it. Everybody's tired on Tisha B'Av. Okay, I mean, it was a joke, just because it wasn't very funny. But the 5th chapter of Gittin talks on Darkei Shalom. The Kohen reads first, where you put an Erev not to have a fight. The fact that in Shemitah year, you can lend your vessels to someone not religious. A problem, Masra, they're going to use it for inappropriate purposes. So the Mishnah has a whole series of laws. Darkei Shalom, we like to. Clearly, that's exactly the problem of the story of the Churban, of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. It was the opposite of the notion of Darkei Shalom, and that's why it's there. The 4th parak actually talks on with another category of rabbinic laws known as Tikkun Olam. We know Tikkun Olam, it's a sort of a catchphrase today, we're involved in Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. So the notion of Tikkun Olam is a whole chapter, and the 4th chapter in Gittin talks about things. That's, for example, you can't pay more for a hostage than what he's worth, because it's not good for our society if people overpay for hostages. Tikkun Olam. Or you cannot have a half slave and a half free person. They had such a person in time of the Talmud, because that person couldn't marry. They couldn't marry a slave because they're half free, and they couldn't marry a free person because they're half a slave. A slave can only marry a slave. A free person can marry a free person. So the Talmud says we force the master to free the slave so he becomes a totally free person. Because law, the world was only created so people could get married. Anyway, that's the context in which the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa takes place. That we sometimes lose sight of. Now it's interesting. The first Mishnah in Masechet Gittin. The first Mishnah in Masechet Gittin is Hamei Biget Mimidinat Hayam. I just found this interesting. I thought of it this week, really, when I was preparing for this. If one brings a get, it was very common that often people didn't, the husband and wife were not living in the same city, and the husband would send his wife a get. Even if they do live in the same city, they don't want to be in the same room at the same time, whatever. So you can send a messenger to give the get. So the Talmud says that if you bring the get from across the Atlantic, maybe get me midinat hayam from far away across the Mediterranean, let's say, maybe not across the Atlantic, whatever, from far away. So the person who brings the get has to say, "Befanai nechtav, it was written in front of me. I know it's written properly because the Jews and living outside of Israel didn't know the law so well, so they had to make sure it's written properly." But if you think about it, well, what's the Masechet keeping up? Maybe get me then hayam. The first thing in Gittin is that people are on opposite ends of the sea. In other words, the whole notion of a get is separation. So we open up the Masechet with the notion of the separation between husband and wife, unfortunately, very far. We just had in Daf Yomi this past week that the Talmud says that when the love between a husband and a wife is strong, they can sleep together on the side of a knife. You know, who needs room? The love is so great, the husband and wife can sleep together on the side of a knife. And when the love is not straight, a bed of 60 cubits, that's about 100 feet wide. So you have a bedroom 100 feet wide, not enough room. So everything is attitude, it's not so. That's what Gittin is separation. And that's what the story of Kamsa, that's why the stories of the Churban. But on the same idea, so that's the big picture. That's what we have to worry about on Tish B'Av Darchei Shalom, what Rabbi Spitz was talking about earlier, Hamet HaShalom HaHavo, to love peace. But you see, let's take another opening of a Mishnah that I think the rabbis are driving at something, that sometimes we miss the boat, we miss the big picture for all the little things. When we think of Shabbos, so what's the most important part of Shabbos? At least let's even talk halakhically, not halakhically, whatever. What's the most important part of Shabbos? Why no one wants to answer questions? Okay. Tisha B'Av, everybody's tired. Zachary, I don't know, the Lametet Melachot, you know, Shabbos is a very, very technical part of Jewish law. There's a lot to know. There's to make Kiddush, the beauty of Shabbos. So you should know, by the way, in Masechet Shabbat, the subject matter that takes up the most space in Masechet Shabbat is caring. Caring. And the Masechet begins with caring. The Talmud calls it the Malechet Grua, a bad Malacha. Why is it bad? Caring. That does make, everybody knows that. The Jews, who the first thing they did before they totally have Shabbos is they would carry on Shabbos. That doesn't make sense. I understand I can't cook. Okay, I can't go to work. But caring, that doesn't make any sense. So already in the time of the Talmud, that's what people said. So the Talmud kind of wanted to strengthen caring. So it's also very complicated. What's fascinating is we have a whole Masechet Erevin that also talks about caring. So half of Shabbos talks about caring, and Masechet Erevin talks about caring. What's the first Mishnah in Shabbos? Shnayim Shehem, Yetzirah Shabbos, Shnayim Shehem Arba. So the Mishnah, who here has learned the Mishnah in Shabbos? I'm just curious. Don't all raise your hands at once. Okay, you want to explain, anybody? You don't want, okay, sorry. Okay, Yetzirah Shabbos. So the Mishnah in Shabbos begins like this. The prohibition of carrying is I have to take something from one area, from a private property, I have to lift it up in a private property, and I have to put it down in a public property. If I walk from my house on the public thoroughfare to your house, and I never stop, I didn't violate the biblical prohibition, a rabbinic prohibition. But even though I went from the private to the public, that's not caring, because I didn't stop. I have to go from the private to the public or the public to the private. I have to pick it up at Akiran Hanachan. I have to stop. But if you don't do both, so the Mishnah describes this case. They give eight examples. Shtayim Shem Arba Bifnim, the Shtayim Shem Arba Chutz. Two that are four, two laws that come into four laws for the one inside, and two laws that are four for the one outside. So there are eight laws, the first mishnah. What's the case? So the case is you got a poor person who's standing outside, and you have the guy in the house, and the poor person's hungry. So he doesn't want a house, so he takes a piece of challah, and he gives him he puts out his hand. So it depends. If the guy from the house takes the challah and puts it in his hand, it's one thing. If he puts it there and the guy grabs it, it's one thing. Or if the guy sticks his hand. So a whole series of cases. How do you violate? Is it a violation of Shabbos? Is it a violation of Shabbos? How do you pass bread from the person standing inside and outside so you don't violate the prohibition of caring? What's the Mishnah telling us? The Mishnah telling us, Shabbos, the first point about Shabbos is taking care of the poor. You're going to worry about lametet malachot. You're going to worry about borer and dash and kotev it's important. But the basic of Shabbos, man, how can you have a situation where a poor person is standing outside and you're inside and you're passing him challah? Invite him into your house. How terrible can this be? How can you have poor people walking on the street? So that's what the Mishnah is saying. Before you begin Hilchot Shabbos, before you even start Hilchot Shabbos, you have to look to see what's going on. I don't know. I think that's a very powerful lesson. Maybe, I don't know if you agree or not, but that's, but by the way, you have a interesting thing in Masechet Pesachim, which is a couple Masechtot later. So the Mishnayos, you have to read the rabbis, they put messages into everything. They packed into everything, little things, but you have to unpack them. So how does Masechet Pesachim begin? Or Larvasar Potim et Hachametz. On the night before Pesach, you have to check Hachametz. So the whole thing, the guy, how much of the wine cellar do you have to check? Guy's got, the Mishnah scribes, 1,000 barrels of wine. That's the description. He has 10 rows of 10 rows that are 10 rows deep. So Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel have a machloket. Beit Hillel says you have to check the first two rows, 20 barrels of wine, that's it. Beit Shammai says you have to check 190 bottles of wine. The first 10 and then back. Because where does the butler go? The discussion is, when you're in the middle of the meal and you run out of wine and you want another fancy bottle of wine, you send the butler downstairs. So how, and the butler's eating food while he's getting you the wine, where's the butler going to drop the chametz? How far in the wine cellar is he going to go? So what's the Mishnah telling us? The Mishnah is telling us that Pesach is luxury. Pesach is freedom, is luxury. You know, we're kings. We all know that to say this. So the Mishnah begins by telling us a message of kingship. How wonderful, drinking wine, butlers, I think. And on Shabbos, we're talking about the poor person outside. Every Mishnah, you have to look not just for, but it's telling you, that's how the Masechet opens. Or a little bit more related to Tisha B'Av, Megillah Nikrat, B'Yod Aleph, Yod Beit, Yod Gimel, Yod Dalet, Tet Vav, Lo Pachot, Lo Yoter. Megillah, we have the strange law by Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther, the Purim, we today read Megillat Esther only on the 14th and the 15th, right? If you live in a unwalled city from the time of Yoshua, the 14th, that's almost everybody. And in Yerushalayim and Shushan and I don't know, maybe Akko or whatever, they read on the 15th day. And the Mishnah says they used to read on the 11th, the 12th, 13th. So I gave a whole shiur this a few months ago, but basically in Yonatan Grossman's book, a fantastic book, I highly recommend it. Rabbi Spitz said you have to get everything, one thing from every shiur. So if the only thing you get from this shiur is that you go home and you read Yonatan Grossman's book on Purim, the shiur will have been very worthwhile to give. It's fantastic. The only problem is, as far as I know, it's only in Hebrew. Megillat Esther, fantastic. So he develops the five stages of the development of the holiday. But the bottom line is that Purim, there was big fights between the Jews living in Israel and the Jews living in Persia. The Jews living in Israel were mad. You know, we had permission to go back to Israel to build a second temple. Ezra, Nehemiah, how many Jews went? 42,000 Jews went? A joke. A joke. I mean, I'm talking to myself, I guess. But nobody went. So the Jews, and they're making celebrations for him. They're going to tell you to go. So the Jews in Israel, no. We're not going to do for him like you. They said, what are you talking about? So there's a fracture. And therefore, in Jerusalem, we don't go from the time of Achashverosh, one walled city. We go back to Yoshua. Because the people in Israel were very, really upset. And the Megillah is read on five different days. What does that mean? Disunity. If Purim is a time, it's meant to be unity. Mishloach Manot, Ish L'Re'ehu. But in a certain sense, the Megillah opens up that there were tensions. You got to look behind. I just mentioned, I think they're interesting ideas, but the point is, when we come to Hilchot Shabbos, the first thing is taking care of the poor. The first halacha in the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchot Pesach, so it's funny, and funny or sad, I don't know. In the Mishnah, we discuss the butler, the family, but he's wealthy, kingship. And that's not the reality of Jewish life, wasn't the reality. Maybe it is today, the fancy hotels, everybody goes away, you know, whatever. But for most of Jewish history, most people couldn't afford this stuff. So the first halacha in Hilchot Pesach is to give matzitzim, to give for the poor. That's the first. Before worrying, you know, that's the famous story. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, "What's the most important thing when you bake matzah?" So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, when they baked matzah in the 1800s, so they didn't have running water, so the people had to care of the water. It was a very low-paying job. They would hire an old woman or whatever, middle-aged woman. That was very, very, very typical in practice. They hire the woman to schlep the water. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said the most important thing when you bake matzah is to make sure the water isn't too heavy. Don't make the woman schlep heavy barrels. You don't have to worry about 18 minutes, 12 and a half minutes, the shmura, we shut this, we shut that. That's later. The first thing you got to do is when you're taking the matzah, make sure the water isn't too heavy. So that's these are things I think we all know, but they're hard to keep, and we don't do them. And that's more important than the all the technical details. Now, let's take one step. How many people are, I don't know what I'm going to do. You don't have to answer. I'll close my eyes, but I'm just answering just for, you know, the fun. A rhetorical question. How many people here have read the introduction of the Netziv, the Sefer to Bereishit? You should hear it. You should hear it at least once a year on Tisha B'Av. I remember the first time I heard this was I was in New York on Tisha B'Av, and somebody mentioned in the Netziv, and he said this should be hung up in every school and every yeshiva in the world in big letters, and he's 100%, and nothing has changed. I should go over it, I don't know who. So the Netziv is bothered by basically the question of how was the Beis HaMikdash all destroyed. So he's really, although he doesn't express it, I'm pretty sure he's bothered by the following question. The Gemara says, Mikdash Rishon Maikar. Why was the first temple destroyed? So, Gila Arayot, Shvichas Damim. What's the third one? Where's Shvichas Damim? Idolatry. You know, the big three. I'm tired also. The big three. Avodah Zarah, Gila Arayot, and Shvichas Damim. The first temple was destroyed because the big three cardinal sins. Avodah Mikdash Sheini. But the second temple, the Talmud says, Hayu Oskim B'Torah. Asadim, the people were studying Torah. They were religious. They were pious. They studied Torah. They studied Torah. And they did acts of kindness for one another. They got it all. They got the Emet and the Shalom. They have the Torah and the Gemilu Chasadim. So the Gemara says, nah, they had Sinat Chinam. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows part two. But a lot of people don't know part one. Everyone knows Sinat. Why? It doesn't make any sense. They had Gmilut Chasadim, but then they had Sinat Chinam. Isn't that a contradiction? If you have Gmilut Chasadim, you don't have any Sinat Chinam. In other words, the Gemara says, the second temple, the Jews were involved in Gmilut Chasadim. So why was it destroyed? Because they had Sinat Chinam. So what do you mean they were involved in Gmilut Chasadim? So the simple answer, I think there's another answer, but the similar answer, and this is, I think, what the Netziv has in mind. It's one page. The whole thing, it's less than a page. He says, basically, Jewish people had selective gemilut chasadim. They did gemilut chasadim to their friends, the people who needed it less. You know, who do we invite to our Shabbos table? Our friends. We don't invite the poor. We don't invite the person who is single from out of town and doesn't know anybody and is going to university here. We don't look for those people. We look to invite our friends. I'm not saying we shouldn't invite our friends. I don't know what I'm saying, but if you think about it, it's more important to do the Gemilat Chesed to people who we're not so friendly with. So the Gemilut Chesed was selective. And Gemilut Chesed that is selective is Sinat Chinam. So then Netziv develops this whole notion that the Jews of the Second Temple, he describes the difference between a tzaddik and a yashar. The a tzaddik is a righteous person, a yashar is a straight person. Basically, a tzaddik, and he says, Because the Torah describes God as a tzaddik v'yashar. Parshat Hazinu, El Emunah Ve'en Avel. God is a faithful God. There's no iniquity. There's no sin. El Emunah Ve'en Tzaddik v'yashar hu. God is a tzaddik and God is a yashar. We know we're supposed to emulate God. So what? And he says, this is why God destroyed the second temple. Because the Jewish people were tzaddikim. They were very religious, but they weren't yasharim. What does yashar mean? Yashar means how to get along with other people who are different than us. He says everybody was very religious, but anybody who was a little bit different than their religious practices, he's a kaifer, a stuki, a apikoris, this or that, nothing to do with him. So he says, God and the language of the Sivir, I don't have it with me, but it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sone. God hates, that's the word, Sone. He hates righteous people like this. They're righteous, but God hates them because they don't know how to get along with other people. And that's why the temple was destroyed. And what is this doing is his introduction to Bereshit. He says, because this is the theme of Sefer Bereshit. Sefer Bereshit in rabbinic literature is known as Sefer HaYashar, the book of the straight, because it teaches us how to get along with other people. Abraham, and the example he uses is Abraham and Sodom. He says Sodom represented the antithesis of everything that Abraham what he stood for, and yet Avraham Avinu was praying for their welfare. And that's everybody. And Yaakov with Laban. Yaakov, the way he was so fair and honest, even though Laban, you know, treated him, he tricked him at every turn. So the Avod and Imahot were Yisharim. They knew how to get along, and Yitzchak makes peace treaties, and that's what it means. That's more important. Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah. Before you can get to the midst of the Torah, the Yashar. So that's how the Netziv explains that being a tzaddik and not a Yashar, just, you can be a tzaddik, you can keep a Torah, but God might hate you. God might hate you. I guess it's a little scary. And, I'm 99.9% sure the person I heard this from is Rabbi Blau, who's still the Mashgiach Ruchani at Yeshiva University. And he was the one who said it should be posted in every school. It's something to go over. It's really unbelievable. But, so the first goal is to be a tzaddik v'yashar. Now, this week, Parsha, we have the mitzvah Vasita Hayashar V'Hatov. Right? We're going to read it on Shabbos. What does Vasita Hayashar V'Hatov mean? So I just explained one point of Yashar, how to get along with people. Right? So Rashi says, the Pshara V'Lifnin Meshurat Hadin. This is what I call compromise. You know, you want to get along with people, you have to compromise. The lifnei meshurat hadin, and doing, how do you translate lifnei meshurat hadin? This one you can answer, right? How do you translate lifnei meshurat hadin? Beyond the letter of the law, is she right? My sister, so I can give her a hard time. Is lifnei beyond? What's lifnei? Before the straightness of the law, lifnei. Everywhere beyond the left, it may mean the same thing. Maybe I'm picking on you unfairly. Lifnei Meshurat Hadin means before the letter of the law. What does that mean? So we just had in Daf Yomi this week, one opinion. Yikov Hadin et Ahar. The law pierces a mountain. Law is, couldn't care less about anything. The law is the law is the law. It doesn't matter if you're rich, if you're poor, if what your social background is. It doesn't matter. Law has to be totally blind to all of life's situations. In other words, it's not law. Yikov Hadin et Ahar, the law must pierce the mountain. But that's not so good. Lifnei Meshurat Hadin is before the law pierces the mountain, before the straightness of the law, before the law just goes straight through your heart, before like it kills you because it's not fair. He's a billionaire and I don't have the money and he is and that, but the law is the law, he's right. So before you gotta act, so you can deflect the notion of the law. I mentioned this morning, the Talmud says, in Bava Metzia, I said the Sinat Chinam is only one. It's only in one Talmudic practice. There are other ones. The Talmud says that the temple was Lo Charba Yerushalayim, Jerusalem was destroyed because the Jewish people observed the laws of the Torah. That's what it says. Hamidu dineim al dinei Torah. They established their laws according to the Torah. And the Gemara said, "Well, that's wonderful." So they said, "No, that's not wonderful. They didn't do lifnei meshurat hadin. They just did din, justice. They didn't do lifnei meshurat hadin." So, Vasita Yashar V'Atov, It's this week's like parsha. So there's a mitzvah in the Torah to do lifnim meshurat hadin. In other words, there are the laws of the Torah, and then there's to go beyond the letter of the law. Okay, beyond the letter of the law to act in a proper. Now it's fascinating. There are even some rishonim. It sounds almost contradictory. Who say we can force a person to act lifnim meshurat hadin. In other words, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. It's not like a nice thing to do. In other words, here are the laws of the Torah. No, there's a mitzvah in the Torah. Vasita yashar v'tov, to do more than what you have to do. Is that a law or not? The law to do more. Now, the Ramban, it says what we call basically a meta mitzvah. So the Ramban in two places, on this pasuk we'll get to in a moment, and on the more famous one that I think is more well known, on Kedoshim to you, to be holy, right? So that's in Vayikra. So the Ramban explains. What's the mitzvah? What does it mean to be holy? To wear a white shirt? I don't know. What does it mean to be holy? I don't know what it means to be holy. So Rashi says to be holy means to separate yourself from sexual sin. That's why Parshat Acharei Mot, we read on Yom Kippur afternoon, the end of Acharei Mot is all the sexual morality, the moral code of Judaism. And then it says, Kedoshim to you. So Rashi says, Yeprushim min arayot. Holiness and the Rambam. In Sefer Kiddushah, the 14 books of the Rambam. So one of the books of the Rambam, Sefer Kiddushah, has Hilchot Isurei Biyah, the laws of forbidden relations, the Hilchot Machalot Asurot, and forbidden foods, right? Holiness is found in sexuality and in eating, the basic physical aspects of man, how we elevate them. That's holiness. That's holiness. The rest of the Parsha. So the Ramban, Nachmanides, has a famous idea that he says, Kedoshim to you is not anything specific. There's no specific mitzvah here. It's an overarching mitzvah. And the Ramban explains that a person can keep the entire Torah, every technical law, be a naval b'shut ha-Torah. What's a naval? So normally they translate a disgusting person, I think. A naval b'shut a terrible person with the permission of the Torah. He doesn't do anything technically wrong. A naval means a nevela, means a carcass, a dead animal. A nevela, we can't eat a nevela. It's not slaughtered probably. A dead carcass has sort of a harsher connotation. You know, persons, he's a carcass. He's a piece of meat with the permission of the Torah. What does it mean? It means a guy can sleep in every day till 11 o'clock in the morning. Can eat 8 pieces of steak. Watch television all day. He did not violate one prohibition of the Torah. There's no prohibition to sleep till 11 o'clock. There's no prohibition to eat meat. There's no prohibition to watch television, at least. Where I come from, there's no prohibition to watch television. Whatever, you know, a person can keep all the law to be a disgusting person. It can be so Kedoshim to you says you have to live. You can't look at the little mitzvah. You have to look at the big picture. How am I presenting myself? So that Kedoshim to you is, I think, relatively well known. And it seems to be in the context that it's really referring to the mitzvah between man and God. In other words, person can eat like a glutton, a glut kosher, whatever. It's not so glut kosher is not only about food. It's about whatever. So that he seems to be talking about the mitzvot between man and God. In this week's parsha, Vasita Hayashar V'atov, so the Ramban explains, what does the Torah do? The Torah gives us all mitzvot. Vasita Lifnim Meshurat Hadin. The Meshurat Hadin is only between man and man. It's not talking between man and God. It's only mitzvot that relate between man and man. We have to go beyond, before the letter of the law, before the straightness of the law, whatever. So, it says the Torah gives us laws. Love your neighbor as yourself. Don't take revenge. Don't talk lashon hara. Pay your worker on time. Many laws that how we have to treat our fellow man. And then the Torah says, but you know what? The Torah can't think of every case. Can't write every case, how things aren't done. Who gets the iPod? Well, you can't write that in the Torah. So the Torah can't write everything. The Torah tells you, we can't tell you everything. We can just give you broad principles, and we want you to apply these principles in Yashar v'hatov. They should be straight. Remember the Netziv. God is a tzaddik v'yashar. If you're not a Yashar, the Netziv says God's going to hate you. Right? So you have to apply lifnim meshurat hadin. I don't know if the Netziv and the Ramban necessarily, work off each other exactly, but if you put it together, that's what you have. The Ramban says, the Torah can't tell us everything, so it says, do lifnim meshurat hadin. So what's the example he gives? This example, I know when I quoted in Shath, when I teach this to my students, of course, everybody thinks I'm crazy. What person today would follow this law? You've got to be out of your mind. So, bar mitzvah. So what's the law of bar mitzvah? Bar mitzvah means like the son of a fence, right? Bar mitzvah, right? So bar mitzvah is the son of mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is the son of a mitzvah, is a fence. So what does that mean? There's a law in Judaism, a lipnin meshurat hadin law in Judaism, that I have a piece of property I want to sell. And it's worth whatever, $1 million, you know, it's 800 square feet, house, whatever it's worth now. It's worth a little less than a few weeks ago, but it's worth a lot of money. So I want to sell it to somebody, and my neighbor, you know, is interested in buying it. No, but my neighbor wants to buy it. Holy cow, because he wants to expand his house and have food together. So to my neighbor, it's about $1 million in market. My neighbor will pay $1.5 million easily for this house. So I'm going to offer it to my neighbor for $1.5 million. He's happy to pay it. My neighbor's happy to pay $1.5 million because he's been looking to get the property next door, which he can't get. So the halacha is you can't do that. You have to sell it to your neighbor for $1 million. Who would do that? So that's what the Ramban says. Basita hayashar v'tov. It's worth $1 million. Don't take advantage of the guy. Just says he's your neighbor. You don't have to give your neighbor a discount. You don't have to sell them for $900,000. But whatever your highest offer is, you have to give the neighbor the right of first refusal. And if you look in the Rambam, you look in the Gemara, the Rambam says, the guy buys the house, and he's on vacation. He's vacationing away. And he comes back and he sees, what are you? Oh, he sold me the house. The neighbor can kick him out. Go to court, get an eviction order. I'm sorry, I had the right to buy that house first. I'm going to kick you out. That's what the Gemara said. There's an exception. If the person that buys it is a widow, an orphan, you see already all these factors play together. You know, which is nice, which not nice. But theoretically, you can kick the guy out. So this is so against Western capitalism. You know, it's a willing buyer. I'm not cheating him. I'm not doing anything. So that's how the Ramban says, that's Vasita Yashar V'Tov. That's the most important to me. Kedoshim to you and Vasita Yashar V'Tov are like the Mena Mitzvot. These are the Mitzvot that define what Judaism is. Then you have technical details. When I can talk Lashon Hara. How much am I allowed to charge? What is interest? What isn't interest? I have technical little details. But the Mena Mitzvah, how to treat people, that comes first. So that's very hard. That's very hard to do, but that's what the Torah demands of us. Ideally, that's what I say. If we're focused too much, if we're focused too much on taking the bones out of the fish on Shabbos, we're not going to focus enough on this. We only have strength to do so much. Where are we going to put all our efforts? We put all our efforts in Orach Chaim, we're not going to have any efforts for Choshen Mishpat. Some people put all their efforts in Choshen Mishpat. Some people are super ethical, and they're very lax in their religiousness. Also not good. It's also not good. You have the reverse too. Works both ways. Now, this idea is, I guess, you see it already how one is supposed to act in the other famous story. The same, back to Masechet Gittin, where we started. So who's the hero, who's the rabbinic hero of Tisha B'Av? You all know this. Don't be afraid. I won't even tell you if you're wrong. Okay, yes. Rabbi Akiva, why do you say that? So he died, so it's very interesting. Rabbi Tabori this morning mentioned that historians went and discussed the Second Temple period and the Second Temple period of the year 135 with the Bar Kokhba revolt. That's continued an extension of the Bar Kokhba period. So if you extend it like that, yes, Rabbi Akiva, absolutely, the eternal optimist of the Jewish people, the one who's laughing when everybody's crying, et cetera, the one hope, right. But during this siege of Jerusalem itself, another rabbinic figure, a couple generations earlier, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, of course, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who basically we're here today only because of him. The last couple of Shabbatot, I've been talking about him, but won't go, but I'll just mention one thing. So everybody knows the famous story. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was smuggled out of Yerushalayim. He had a good relations with the Romans. He was what we would call today a peacenik, you know, and he was fighting. His nephew was head of the Zealots. And the zealots burned all the food. There was enough food for 21 years, the Talmud says, to survive in Jerusalem. And the people who wanted to fight the Romans wanted a fort. They didn't want to make a peace treaty with the Romans. They wanted to fight till the end. Very sad, very tragic. And they burned the food to force the issue. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai called his nephew, "What are you doing? Are you guys crazy? What do you think? First of all, we're not going to win. Like to fight, you know, you're nuts." And he said, "What can he do?" Anyways, he got smuggled out of Yerushalayim, and they wanted to open up his kever, and they said, "Kava," they probably knew, you know, already. He went to Vespasian, and he said, "Shalom Alech HaMelech," the king. He wasn't the king yet, or the Caesar, and he got all upset, and then the messenger came, and he said, "He is the Caesar." He told Rav Yochanan, "I'll give you whatever you want." So Rav Yochanan says, "Tein li Yavne v'chachameha," give the Yavne and its wise people. And the Rabbi Akiva says, "Oh my God, the guy's crazy. The guy's nuts. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, you could have saved Yerushalayim. What did you do?" Meshiv chachamim mirosh. Sometimes smart people are stupid. Really, I mean, I know it's not nice. I know it doesn't sound nice. But if you look in the Gemara, that's really what he said. Meshiv chachamim achor. Sometimes the wisdom of the smart people leaves them, goes backwards. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, why didn't he ask for Yerushalayim? He didn't ask because it wouldn't have done any good. They didn't need the Beit HaMikdash at that point. It was just a useless building. They had to recreate Yerushalayim. That's everybody knows. What's the second thing? He was given three things. What's the second thing he asked for? Most people know that one. The next two are less famous. One of them even less, I think. So number two, I think this is actually number three, but he says, a doctor for Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok needs a doctor. Who is Rabbi Tzadok? So Rabbi Tzadok was a contemporary of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and people knew the end was near. The corruption, the infighting, the non-being yesharim, the folk, on the one hand, the great piety, religiosity, but somehow missing the gemilut chesed to other people. So Rav Tzadok was fasting for 40 years, the Gemara says. I don't know that it's literal. 40 is always transformation. 40 days before the flood is born, the 40 days of the flood, the 40 days at Har Sinai, the 40 years in the desert. 40 is a transformative number, change, transformative. So Rav Tzadok fasted for 40 years to avert the decree of the temple. So I guess he ate at night, but still. Wasn't so healthy. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, get a doctor for Rav Tzadok. And Rav Soloveitchik points out, and this is really the theme of the keynote, many of the keynote this morning, the big picture and the little picture. On the one hand, he has to save Judaism. He has to recreate Judaism. But on the other hand, you can't forget about Rabbi Tzadok. You have to have both in tandem. It's a beautiful thing. The saving of one life, we say, is like saving an entire world. So he asked on the one hand to save, to recreate, you know, Judaism, let us alone in peace so we can create the Mishnah and we can create the oral law and rabbinic Judaism. And probably had the Romans known how successful they would have been, they wouldn't have agreed. I think the Romans thought they were no threat. Had the Romans known how successful Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would be when he recreated Judaism and Rabbi Akiva and all the Rabbi Elazar ben Azari and Rabbi Gamliel and all the people came, and Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Tarfon, the people we read about, had he known how amazing they would have been, they probably wouldn't have agreed. But they agreed. And he saved Judaism, a doctor for Rabbi Tzadok. So you have the high and low. And then he asked for a third thing. It was very interesting. He said, save the family of Rabban Gamliel. Now this is what I would like to say. It's a little thing that turned into a big thing. In other words, Rabban Gamliel, okay, save the family. It's like saving Rabbi Tzadok. But the truth of the matter is, Rabban Gamliel's family was the family that produced every leader for from before him and from after him. Six generations of a row, from Hillel to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, or son after son after son, Rav Shimon Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel, Rav Shimon Gamliel again, and right, and then Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, but to save the family. So this is really putting together the big and the little picture into one. That's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We have that in the keynote. You have the keynote destruction, though. I don't know, different people do different keynotes. So you have the keynote, let's say, of the of Rabbi Yishmael's two kids. Anybody do that? That keynote, very powerful, poignant, keynote. That Rabbi Yishmael had a son and daughter. Rabbi Yishmael was one of the Asara Harugei Malkut. And remember, he was killed. He was very beautiful. He was very, very handsome. And even the Roman execution, the daughter of the Roman executioner said, we want to save his life. He's so handsome. And this morning, you know, to save him, he was, you know. And instead, I mean, it's like unbelievable. Instead, they peeled his face off to save the face instead of saving him. That's an instead, right? So Rabbi Shmuel had two beautiful children, a son and a daughter. And they were taken captives, and they were slaves. This is one of the keynotes we read this morning. So they were taken slave, and then the two masters met each other. They said, oh, I have a slave and you have a slave. Why don't we marry them up? Beautiful slaves will have beautiful children. And they put them in a dark room. They couldn't see each other. And each one is crying, I, the son of Rabbi Shmuel, is going to marry a slave. And this one's saying, I, the daughter of Rabbi Shmuel, is going to marry a slave. And they're crying all night. In the morning, it gets light. They can see each other. They recognize each other. They hug each other, and they die. And they die in embrace. What's the point of that? We talk about the Beit HaMikdash, the big picture, destruction of Jerusalem, but we talk about the personal. I mean, I think that's also important. It also, of course, is much more poignant. We all know, Stalin, Yamach Shmo's, you know, famous line that the death of a million, like, people is a statistic. The death of one person is a tragedy. We all know that. So when you personalize, that's the Asara Harugei Malchut. So it's very important to personalize also. But it's also caring. You know, you can think of big picture. You have to bring it down to person. That's the Jewish approach, to somehow meld the big and the small. We mentioned earlier that one of the views of the most important mitzvah in the Torah is you bring the korban tamid. You bring the sacrifice in the morning every day a little bit, and the same sacrifice at night. Consistency. Consistency, that's the most important, day in and day out. The more famous ones, of course, is what Rabbi Akiva says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. I don't know, do we really think that's the most important possible? I mean, do we act as if this is the most important possible? What does it mean to love your neighbor yourself? So if you really love, hold this possible, bar mitzvah wouldn't be a problem. You would have no problem giving your neighbor the feel for $1 million instead of $1.5 million. Because the Mefarshim saying, we can't love our neighbors ourselves. All the commentaries understand that. It's impossible. The Torah often does that, by the way. The Torah writes something that's, I don't want to even know if we call it an ideal. The Torah writes sort of on a divine perspective, you know, on some notion we should love our neighbor as ourselves. But in a practical notion, it's impossible. That's why it's the same Rabbi Akiva. It's the same Rabbi Akiva who says this is the most important verse in the Bible, who says that if two people are in the desert with one canteen of water, chayecha kodmi, your life takes precedence. It's the same Rabbi Akiva. It's not a contradiction. It's not true. We love our relatives more than we love everybody else. That's the way it's meant to be. But it's lireyecha kamocha. So you have to love. The same way I want to have money and I want a comfortable, and I don't want people insulting me and I don't want this. That's what you should want for your friends. You don't want to be ripped off in a business deal? Don't rip off the other kind of business. You want to share with me? That's what v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. It's very hard. It's a very hard. It's very nice. We all give it a platitude. The most important, in pasuk, but it's very, very hard to observe. It's the flip side. Everyone knows it's the flip side of what Rabbi what Hillel said. It's a higher level. What Hillel says is what's hateful to you, don't do unto others. That's already a lower level. V'ahavta l'reicha is more positive. Halavai, we should be on Hillel's level. Halavai, we should all be on Hillel's level. What's hateful to you, don't want to others. I heard, actually, it's very interesting. I never really thought of this before, but it's obvious that Hillel was talking to a non-Jew who wanted to convert. So in the relations to non-Jews, our relationship, what's hateful to you, don't do others. It's good enough, right? But when it comes to Jews, Reacha has the connotation of really your fellow man, your fellow Jew. That's a higher level. That's for Jews. To non-Jews, it's just, you know, we just have to be like Hillel. But we have to move up to Rabbi Akiva for other people. So that's very, very hard. And this idea, this sort of idea of Hillel and Rabbi Akiva, I think, is reflected in the second opinion, right? What's the most important verse there? So we did 1 and 3. Love your neighbors yourself. Bring the korban tamid every day. The middle view is that Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam. I think in the beginning of Perikei in Bereishit, this is the book of the generations of man that were created in God's image. That's, in a sense, even a higher level. to realize that everybody's created in God's image, then you'll automatically act in a certain way. And that, of course, applies. This is written in Perikei, in Bereishis, before Abraham. This is written Jews and non-Jews. So when the Ein Yaakov quotes this notion of the three most important verses in the Torah, it means these are the three things we should be focusing on. So, you know, we all too often focus on the wrong things. As we said, we only have a certain amount of spiritual strength. Halavai, we should have more, and if you practice, you get more, but we only have so much, and we use it all in one area, and we're going to have less in the other area. So you have to know the importance of being a yeshar, the importance of lifnei mishurat hadin. We have to know that before we begin Shabbos, we have to make sure the poor are taken care of. Yetzirat Shabbos Shtayim Arba. We have to realize Darchei Shalom, the whole portion of the Churban, Kamsan, Karpsan, because they didn't follow the Mishnayos of Darchei Shalom. And we have to learn how to combine the great and the small and together and put as our sort of key like targets before us, Kedoshim Tiyu, and Basita HaYashar V'Hatov, and V'Yadav HaShar V'Hatov, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu would love us all. We'd know how to get along with each other, then we wouldn't have to observe Tisha B'Av anymore.